Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. It's now been more than a year since the first data became available on the use of trastuzumab as adjuvant therapy of patients with HER2-positive invasive breast cancers, and clinical investigators are continuing to scramble to make these fascinating findings available to clinicians in practice. I met with Dr. Mark Pegram to get his take on how this is shaking out in clinical practice and where things are headed in new clinical trials. And to make this discussion as practical as possible, I asked Dr. Pegram to present a patient from his practice who typifies some of the challenges medical oncologists now face. Dr. Pegram discussed a patient who was very adverse to the idea of receiving chemotherapy.
I've recently seen a woman in her late 60s, I believe she was around 68 years old, and she presented with mammographically detected breast cancer, had a corneal biopsy, was positive for infiltrating ductal carcinoma. I think there was a small component of DCIS. And she went on to have a surgical lumpectomy and sentinel lymph node biopsy. The sentinel lymph node was negative. The tumor size was around 1.5 centimeters. The sentinel lymph node biopsy was negative. The tumor characteristics on histology were a poorly differentiated tumor with a small component of ductal carcinoma in situ. The estrogen receptor was weakly positive, the progesterone receptor was negative, and the HER2 gene was strongly amplified with a HER2 gene to chromosome 17 centromere ratio of about 10 to 1.
What was the actual quantitative or percent of the ER?
The ER was weakly staining in a minority of the tumor cells, like 30 or 40% of the cell nuclei were stained, but the staining was just weak intensity, which is actually classical for a HER2 amplified tumor to have downregulation of the estrogen receptor.
Right, and you published on that?
Yes.
So that's kind of a typical ER positive, HER2 positive scenario.
Small tumor, lymph node negative. In past years, this might be someone by virtue of her age, for example, that we might not even consider for chemotherapy treatment in the adjuvant setting, but rather rely on endocrine therapy because of its smoother toxicity profile.
Can you talk a little bit about the woman in terms of her lifestyle and personality?
She was a busy business professional. She loathed the idea of toxicity from chemotherapy. I think she had had a recommendation from a referring oncologist to consider chemotherapy. We certainly discussed it as an option in her case as well. But she, I think, was very fearful. I believe she had a close relative who had been through chemotherapy for breast cancer in the past and, had an unpleasant experience. And so, this was a person who really was thoughtful, well-educated, I think had the capacity to understand, data, and I think brought a thoughtful perspective to the whole case.
Had she been out on the net looking
for
stuff?
Sure. I mean, all of the patients in West Los Angeles have been on the internet and bring in large packets of printouts from their home computer.
What was her family situation and what support did she have?
She was married, a couple of grown children, a supportive situation.
Can you talk a little bit about the discussions that went on between you and the patient about what to do?
Right. Well, in this situation, there's always a dilemma as to whether or not to employ systemic adjuvant chemotherapy. That's always the issue with these small mammographically detected lymph node negative cases. And these cases are just increasing with frequency because of the use of mammography and its utility in early detection, which is a wonderful thing. But we really got into quite serious issues about chemotherapy and its side effects. And, to what degree it would reduce risk of relapse if you use computer algorithms like Adjuvant Online, which don't yet incorporate HER2, for example, in the equation. But if you look at the hazard ratios for tamoxifen therapy for, let's say, a small ER-positive tumor, and then add in chemotherapy and see how much it actually adds very little in terms of, real percentage differences in these types of estimations. And so patients who can critically look at that sort of data oftentimes will decline chemotherapy for small node negative tumors. Now this one is, 1.5 centimeters is not that small. And so she was certainly a candidate for chemotherapy, though she actually in the end declined it.
What was she most concerned about in terms of the chemotherapy? What kinds of side effects or issues?
Alopecia and gastrointestinal upset, I think, were the major concerns in this particular case.
And, it's interesting you mentioned about Adjuvant Online, which, as you say, doesn't currently incorporate HER2 as a prognostic factor or trastuzumab. Did you actually get into what you thought her numbers were with her?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many situations, I'll actually, print out the results from Adjuvant Online, go through it with patients, or at least look at it in my office before going into the exam room so they have the numbers fresh in mind to give people realistic estimates. Because what I find, since I do a number of second opinions in a university-based clinic, is that generally patients have been given what I consider to be probably overestimates of the utility of systemic adjuvant chemotherapy for small lymph node negative tumors. And so when they see the real numbers, it is sometimes quite sobering. But it gives them, you know, I believe it empowers patients to make informed decisions. And so these types of algorithms I find very useful.
So what was your best estimate in her situation in terms of what her baseline risk of relapse was, say, over 10 years, how that would be decreased by hormonal therapy, then by adding in chemo, and then adding trastuzumab on top of that?
Well, let's start with just HER2 gene amplification itself and its role in pathogenesis and lymph node negative disease and its effect on prognosis. There are a number of studies from Mike Press and others showing that HER2 is a prognostic factor even in lymph node negative disease. And if you look at a composite of many data sets over the years, many of which have not used FISH for HER2 detection, but if you look at all the data sets available, the risk for HER2, the HER2 alteration in early stage breast cancer is probably about a 1.5-fold increased risk of recurrence. And it may actually be more than that if you use FISH selection, but if you just look at all the historical data, it increases risk by conservatively about 1.5-fold. So all bets are off with this particular case using the traditional risk assessments, including adjuvant online. So we also know that since HER2 amplification is associated with downregulation of steroid hormone receptor expression, and in as much as steroid hormone receptor expression is directly related to the utility of adjuvant hormone therapy, we know that this patient's efficacy from the hormone therapy standpoint is actually diminished compared to an average ER-positive case that's HER2 negative. So you can't really rely on what you think you know from historical data sets about the efficacy of endocrine therapy in these HER2-positive cases, because those data sets just don't apply.
So understanding that this is really starting to, you know, get into the issue of sort of the art of oncology, what was your best estimate of what her baseline risk of relapse was?
Well, I mean, I think for these node-negative tumors that are, in this case, actually fairly sizable, 1.5 centimeters, she probably has a 20-30% risk of recurrence in the next 5 to 10 years. It's going to be just like a T1N1 HER2-negative case. In fact, Giovanni Paoletti looked at a cohort of over 900 primary breast cancers in a collaboration with Ram Seshadri from South Australia and published the work in the JCO. And in that paper, he found that T2N0 HER2-amplified disease has the same prognosis as T1N1 HER2 non-amplified disease.
What about the potential role, if any, of the Oncotype DX assay in this situation and also in the HER2 negative ER positive situation?
In this situation, I don't think it's very helpful because of Soon-Paik's subset analysis from the NSABP dataset upon which the Oncotype assay was based. When he did HER2-FISH testing on that cohort, what he found is that all of the HER2-amplified cases were either intermediate or high risk, and none of them, zero, as I recall, were in the low-risk strata.
Right, but I guess I wondered whether or not would seeing her in the intermediate group help at all?
Intermediate group never helps me at all with the Oncotype DX assay under any circumstance, so even that wouldn't be very helpful.
Just to sort of divert out for a second, what are your thoughts about it in the HER2-negative, ER-positive, node-negative situation?
Sure. There are some instances where I've ordered the assay in that setting because if they're HER2 non-amplified, then they could easily fall into the low-risk strata. And if they have other, you know, biomarkers that are somewhat mixed, then I have found that that test can be a reasonable test to get, especially as a consultant where there may be a mixed vote from the referring community oncologists. Oftentimes, patients who see me have seen two or three other oncologists, and they want essentially a tiebreaker. So when they find out that they can make a decision that's data-driven based on gene expression profiles, that's quite attractive to them. There are some situations where I think Oncotype DX, even in the ER-positive, HER2-negative situation, is probably not necessary. For example, a tubular, well-differentiated, small lymph node negative tumor, I mean, that's never going to be anything other than low risk, in my view, with that sort of assay. So you could probably save yourself the cost of doing the test just based on your knowledge of the disease.
So in this older postmenopausal woman, what was your best guess in terms of how that baseline risk would be affected by chemotherapy and hormonal therapy?
I really felt strongly that I wouldn't want to rely on endocrine therapy alone in a case like this because of the rather modest estrogen receptor expression and low intensity expression and the fact that it's HER2 amplified. So, you know, I would think that though endocrine therapy may be useful in this case, its utility will be markedly attenuated by the HER2, you know, crosstalk with the estrogen receptor.
So assuming, let's talk about the pre-adjuvant Herceptin data days, that she would be willing to consider, you know, chemotherapy and hormonal therapy, maybe even a taxane-based program, how much do you think that baseline risk would come down?
Well, I mean, with chemotherapy, of course, it would be reduced, you know, significantly. And in the pre-Herceptin era, this patient certainly would have been considered a candidate for chemotherapy followed by endocrine therapy. And, you know, again, it's hard to tell based on historical data sets since they don't incorporate HER2 very often in assessment of risk reduction, for example, in the overview analysis. But typically, you know, you can expect that endocrine therapy for ER-positive disease all comers is going to reduce the hazard of relapse by, you know, something like a third, and chemotherapy can give you an additional 20% on top of that, something like this.
So what was your best estimate the risk of relapse would have been affected if this woman was willing to go full bore with chemotherapy, trastuzumab, and endocrine therapy?
Well, I mean, I think that the hazard ratios for all of the adjuvant Herceptin trials that have been reported, all of which have used chemotherapy, you know, in combination with Herceptin or chemotherapy followed by Herceptin, all of them are coming in around a half, you know, just remarkable consistency across all of the studies. So I would estimate, and remember that hazard ratio of 0.5 is above and beyond chemotherapy. So clearly
Herceptin. And hormone therapy.
And hormone therapy, correct. And in subset analysis, the hazard ratio in favor of Herceptin is similar for ER-positive and ER-negative disease. And in the European HERA trial, it was similar for lymph node-negative disease. So really, Herceptin is going to be the workhorse in a case like this in the modern era, and chemotherapy and endocrine therapy will have much less robust effects compared to the Herceptin.
Returning now to the art of oncology, what happened with the discussions with this woman?
Well, she was very, you know, intensely fearful of chemotherapy, having seen someone go through it previously, and she just really was unwilling to consider the side effects. You know, we discussed the various chemotherapy regimens that have been tested with Herceptin, including the 9-anthracycline-based regimens. However, she really was not interested in chemotherapy at all, despite having some recommendations from myself and others to consider it. And she felt comfortable that the efficacy of Herceptin, which had recently been demonstrated, would be sufficient in her mind to reduce her risk of recurrence when given in combination with endocrine therapy. So she actually opted for endocrine therapy and Herceptin. And this isn't the only case who I've treated in such a fashion off protocol within the past few months. I mean, for ladies that are in their 70s or 80s and really have small tumors, in the previous era, we would have considered them really non-ideal candidates for chemotherapy in any setting. But in the Herceptin era, they, you know, since it's relatively non-toxic, especially if it's given without chemotherapy, and if it can reduce the hazard of relapse by half, you have to consider it. It's an option.
So what hormonal therapy did you utilize?
We wound up using Arimidex just because of the first-line data from the ATTACK trial that's been out now for years.
And what schedule of trastuzumab?
We wound up using every 3 week, 6 mg/kg every 3 weeks, and we'll plan to give it for a year.
And how long has she been under treatment now?
It's been, I think, about 3 months or so.
How's she doing?
Doing well.
Any problems with the aranastrozole?
No real problems. Typical, you know, hot flashes, maybe some bone or joint complaints, but really nothing that would be dose limiting.
If she had agreed to chemotherapy and had no major, you know, issues with it, which chemotherapy would you recommend?
Well, this is a situation where, you know, the toxicity and efficacy ratio really plays a major role in these lymph node negative cases, in my view. And so I think I'm much less willing to accept a significant risk of cardiotoxicity for a lymph node negative patient as compared to a lymph node positive one that has a much higher risk of relapse and death from the disease. So this is a case where if I were to have given her chemotherapy, I would have certainly offered her, you know, a non-anthracycline-based regimen as one of the options based on the BCRG data.
Specifically TCH?
Specifically TCH.
I want to explore that a little bit. I assume this woman had a normal ejection fraction?
She did.
In terms of what you ended up doing with this woman, we should qualify this to say that I've asked quite a few breast cancer clinical investigators about this concept of trastuzumab without chemo, and I would say that you're in the minority. A lot of them are not comfortable with it at this point.
Sure.
And I guess it just gets into the old, how much evidence or evidence base do you need in order to take action?
That's right, and I respect that point of view completely. I have no problem with it. I'm more perhaps biology-driven, and I think about the disease in the context of what we know about even gene expression profiles. You can pick out the HER2 amplified cases based on their broad gene expression profile. So there's something really unique about the HER2 driven biology. And that's why I feel, you know, comfortable predicting what is likely to happen in the future. Plus, the other thing that gives me confidence is this subset analysis in the lymph node negative group in the European adjuvant Herceptin data set.
And there were some node negative patients in the BCRG trial.
There were a substantial fraction. As I recall, I think it's about 29-30%. That subset has not yet been reported, though, so I don't have any data to offer at this time, but it will be eventually looked at critically.
And the other thing about that is I believe the BCRG trial is the only one that allowed node negative tumors under a centimeter. They had to have some other, for example, ERPR negative, age under 35. There were several qualifiers.
That's right. They had to have ER negative disease or increased markers of proliferation, for instance, as I recall.
Yeah. But there were patients under, which is another area of huge controversy.
I don't know that there will be enough in that subset, even in that trial, to be able to draw any conclusions.
But just, you know, the best that people can do sometimes is to say, well, let me pick the eligibility criteria of the trials.
Yes.
And I guess you can say, I mean, it was a spectrum of what kinds of node negative criteria were allowed. The NSAPB didn't even allow node negative. I think the intergroup was ER positive over 2 centimeters or ER negative over 1 centimeter. Mm-hmm. Your trial had actually allowed under 1 centimeter with these other qualifiers. What about the patient with a HER2 positive tumor, either ER positive or ER negative under 1 centimeter?
Well, that's where I'm starting to get even uncomfortable making any sort of broad recommendations, because the prognosis of that group in historical data sets is exceptional. And at some point, you are going to be splitting hairs. If somebody's risk of relapse is only 5%, and let's say you can cut that in half with Herceptin, is that worth the effort and the toxicity, et cetera? And that's a real gray area, and that's something that the patient has to play an important role in making those kind of decisions. For some patients, a 1% difference is important to them, and for other patients, they would say, well, 99% of the patients aren't going to benefit, so why would I want to bother?
What about the strategy of trastuzumab alone or trastuzumab plus hormone therapy in clinical trials? Is that being pursued, or will it be pursued?
You know, I don't really know if there's enough momentum to really do that, although in the future there will certainly be enough cases because of mammographically detected lesions getting smaller and smaller all the time. There will be an opportunity to do that, but the biology speaks awfully loudly, and except for these exceptionally small tumors, I don't know whether it would be ethical to randomize patients to a non-Herceptin arm. The other thing about endocrine therapy and Herceptin, of course, is this concept of crosstalk between receptor tyrosine kinases like HER2 and steroid hormone receptors. So that's another really, I think, potentially critical interaction that you can exploit by combining endocrine therapy with Herceptin.
You started her on aromatase inhibitor anastrozole. Where are we right now in terms of looking at endocrine therapy based on HER2 status? That's kind of bounced around for the last 5 or 10 years.
Sure has.
What's your current take?
Well, you know, we published a paper in the JNCI looking at a cohort of over 900 patients from Munich with Michael Unsch's group there and Gottfried Konechny. And basically, when we measured estrogen receptor and progesterone receptor using a quantitative assay, that is the old radioligand binding assay, so we get true quantitative numerical results for these receptors, and then we measured HER2 gene copy number quantitatively using FISH, we found a very strong inverse correlation between the two, which, you know, had been identified by other groups using other techniques as well. So that was no big deal. However, if you look at that data set critically, what it predicts is that all of these HER2-positive, ER-positive patients will have a lower response to endocrine manipulation by virtue of the fact that they have lower estrogen receptor expression levels and because of the crosstalk, which can actually activate the estrogen receptor even in the absence of estradiol. So what all that predicts is that HER2 will confer endocrine resistance regardless of the class of endocrine agent that's used. It'll confer tamoxifen resistance, AI resistance, you know, SERMs, you name it. I'll bet you that HER2 will be associated with endocrine resistance regardless of what endocrine manipulation you use. And if you look at Matt Ellis's newest data using fish on a larger cohort, what he's finding is exactly the opposite of what he originally published in his neoadjuvant study with regard to neoadjuvant aromatase inhibitors. That is, it was the HER2 non-amplified cases that most benefited from the aromatase inhibitors, and the HER2 amplified cases, it didn't reach statistical significance when he compared tamoxifen to an aromatase inhibitor, and that's in press now in JCL.
There has been the perception that AIs in postmenopausal women would be more effective in HER2-positive tumors than tamoxifen based on various clinical data sets. You mentioned this newest data set that Ellis is going to publish. Overall, when you look at the data out there, is there a consistent story, though?
I don't think so, Neil. I think that if you look at the data critically, AIs as a class are generally superior to tamoxifen, regardless of the HER2 status. In HER2 negative, it's superior, and in HER2 positive, even though in Matt Ellis's recent data set, it doesn't quite reach statistical significance, there's still a numerical trend in favor of the AI over a SERM. So I think that AIs as a class are just more active, whether you're HER2 positive or HER2 negative.
You know, this issue of hormonal therapy plus trastuzumab and, you know, sort of what the crosstalk might be. You guys have been talking for a while about the possibility of combining fulvestrant with trastuzumab. When you look at sort of tamoxifen, the AIs, and fulvestrant, what seems to make the most sense in terms of the combination?
What actually makes the most sense to me is fulvestrant. And the reason is, you can see ligand-independent activation of the estrogen receptor in HER2-positive breast cells. That is, the crosstalk between HER2 signaling and the estrogen receptor can activate estrogen-dependent genes in the absence of estradiol. So what that predicts is that with aromatase inhibitors, you'll have an absence of estradiol, no ligand for the ER, but the ER can still be turned on by HER2 signaling. So that's kind of a strike against AIs. SERMs, we know, can actually be more agonistic after this crosstalk mechanism. So how can you tackle such a complex issue? Well, an ideal would be to get rid of the estrogen receptor, and that's exactly what fulvestrant does. And so it is very appealing from a theoretical point of view to incorporate HER2-directed therapy with fulvestrant. And we have a randomized phase 2 trial underway in the metastatic setting comparing fulvestrant alone to trastuzumab alone to the combination. It's accruing very slowly, unfortunately, at the moment, and may have to be pared down, and some of the arms may have to be dropped in order to, you know, get some point estimate on the activity of the combination in the future. But it's open at this point. Rich Petras is the principal investigator at UCLA.
So when you see a patient with metastatic disease that's ER positive and HER2 positive, a postmenopausal patient, first of all, do you ever utilize trastuzumab plus hormonal therapy together in the metastatic setting?
Absolutely. Yes, I have a number of patients who are on fulvestrant and trastuzumab who are doing well, even though they were started on the treatment off protocol because the protocol wasn't open back when they started, and they're still on it. So I've had some very nice anecdotal responders on that combination. Now, remember, many of these patients have already seen adjuvant AIs anyway. So, you know, fulvestrant is a very reasonable consideration when they relapse.
What about the selection of hormonal therapy in the HER2-positive postmenopausal patient where the doc's not going to use trastuzumab? First of all, you know, what's your take in terms of just the clinical research data comparing fulvestrant to AIs for tamoxifen? And would you tend to think more, even if you're using endocrine therapy alone, to use fulvestrant?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, it is one of the arms on Rich's phase 2 randomized trial, in fact. So, you know, I have to believe that it would be entirely reasonable as an option for patients. Which agent to use up front, I'm probably less concerned about with the endocrine therapies because these ER-positive patients are going to see all of these drugs at the end of the day, and which order they see them and may not be particularly important. And so it's not a real pressing issue in my own practice. If somebody comes in on an AI, I'll leave them on. I'm not going to try to switch them to something different based on theoretical considerations.
The issue of trastuzumab monotherapy also brings up what you referred to earlier, which is delayed trastuzumab monotherapy. Patients, as you said, who've gotten chemotherapy and maybe hormonal therapy in the past and now coming in after these data have come out. How are you approaching that situation?
It's really difficult. You know, George Sledge at the plenary session at ASCO in 2005 suggested that we ought to offer it to everybody out to 6 months. And then the first patient I saw after I got back to Los Angeles after that ASCO was presented to me by one of the fellows at UCLA, and they said, here's a patient that's got 8 positive lymph nodes, and they're 8 months out from their adjuvant chemotherapy, and they're HER2 amplified. So I came up with a rule that as many lymph nodes as they have, that's the number of months minimum that it should be considered in the adjuvant setting to add in Herceptin. And, you know, I just say that only jokingly. Obviously, I don't follow that as a real rule. But consider this, Neil, that we know that Herceptin prolongs survival for established metastasis. In metastatic disease, it prolongs survival. We know it reduces the odds of relapse in early stage disease, which is micrometastatic disease, arguably, by half, and that's across many studies, when given in the adjuvant settings for early stage disease. So what are the odds that there won't be a survival benefit somewhere between those two extremes? The odds are almost zero that there wouldn't be some benefit for Herceptin somewhere in between diagnosis and metastasis. It's effective everywhere along that continuum, most likely. So I don't think there probably should be a time limit.
Yeah, your colleague Dennis Lehman talks about the two goalposts in that same manner and that same concept that you're talking about. But it also ties into what we think the residual risk of relapse is at any given point.
Right.
I mean, if you're dealing with a woman who you think is, you know, got a residual risk of relapse of 5%, that's different. But I don't know whether we really have those kinds of data. For example, this woman with 8 positive nodes, if she came to you at 2 years or 3 or even 5 years, you know, assuming she'd had chemotherapy, let's say she was ER negative, what would you estimate at those time points her residual risk of relapse would be?
I would estimate that it's still very high.
So, I mean, would you treat her at 5 years?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't faced that particular situation in 5 years. You're right. At some point, obviously, the risk would be diminished sufficiently where I wouldn't worry about it as much. But it's a continuum. There's no benchmark that I can think of biologically, you know, past which you wouldn't consider it outright.
Well, you know, we've really gotten sensitized to the long-term time course of recurrence because of the AI data. And at the December 2005 San Antonio meeting, there was even more data with Paul Goss presenting data on AIs and women who'd been off tamoxifen for 2 or 3 years and still seeing a big benefit. When I bring up that issue as it relates to trastuzumab, people often say, well, the HER2-positive patients relapse early.
Yeah.
But again, do you still see relapses in years 5 to 10, and can we quantify that?
I don't know that there's a large, robust data set that can give you, you know, really hard quantitation of that risk. But in my experience, I've certainly seen late relapses that I would have predicted would be HER2-negative, but when you test them, they're actually amplified. So, you know, I have personally seen late relapses even in HER2-positive disease. Now, the majority relapse early, you're right. But I have seen, in unusual cases, late metastatic disease.
Now, what would you base your use of trastuzumab without chemotherapy on in terms of clinical trial data? As far as I know, there's none.
There isn't any in the adjuvant setting. We know the drug is active both in the neoadjuvant setting and as well in the metastatic setting as a single agent. So it clearly has single agent activity, you know, no matter how you look at it. And I think it's important to remember that in many of the adjuvant studies, the regimens that were employed were actually chemotherapy followed by a single agent Herceptin. So it's not as if you can say that all of the efficacy of adjuvant Herceptin is due to synergism between chemo and Herceptin. That's clearly not the case. There may be some, but that clearly doesn't explain all of the benefit.
No, you're talking about basically the HERA study in that regard.
And one of the arms in the intergroup trial was chemo followed by Herceptin.
And actually, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, a lot of people look at those data and they hear Edith Perez say, well, you didn't really see a statistically significant benefit when it was used sequentially, even though they'd only had, I think, a quarter of the number of relapses they wanted to have.
The other comparison she makes is between the ACTH arm versus the ACT followed by
right.
H arm. And even that had a difference. And the p-value was less than 0.05, though at the benchmark of an interim analysis, you know, I doubt that surpasses any sort of O'Brien-Fleming statistical confidence boundary.
Well, that analysis showed that the concurrent was statistically better than the sequential.
I think you should use the word statistically better in big quotes,
okay,
because it is an interim analysis, and
right,
that p-value, though it was less than 0.05, I don't know that that is a reliable conclusion just yet.
So the bottom line is, obviously, the HERA study showed a very robust effect, 50% reduction using chemotherapy followed by trastuzumab.
Mm-hmm.
I take it that I would guess that if you had your preference, you're using concurrent?
Yeah. I mean, you know, though the statistics may not quite be there yet from the intergroup analysis, I believe that that conclusion will probably turn out to be correct, that chemo plus Herceptin will probably be a bit better than chemo followed by Herceptin.
But I also take that you think that the HERA approach of chemo followed by trastuzumab has a significant effect on recurrence.
Sure, and when I see patients referred to my office for a second opinion and they've had a recommendation to have, let's say, chemo followed by Herceptin, a la the European approach, I'm not going to quibble over that issue at all. I would say that that's a perfectly reasonable option, and there's a huge data set in support of that option.
Now, you talked about the fact that you look at the quantitative ER in general when trying to estimate the potential benefit of hormone therapy, which I think all of us do. What about the quantitative amplification in terms of FISH? A lot of people have questions about that. We have this intuitive feeling that it's going to work better. What do we know about that?
We know very little, unfortunately, and this was the second most frequently asked question in my clinic after ASCO 2005, and I, to this day, get a call at least once a week from referring oncologists where the HER2 to chromosome 17 centromere ratio is 2.1 or
right,
2.2, and should
right,
they get Herceptin, and will they benefit as much? My understanding in talking with Edith Perez recently at a meeting is that they're looking at this critically in the intergroup data set. And Edith has described to me that there may be actually a trend towards greater efficacy with higher copy number. Now, I've not seen the data. This is hearsay at this point. But I think it's something that, you know, the good news is we'll have these wonderful large data sets to really ask that question. It's an important biological question. And when we look at the data, it'll be also very critical to find out, you know, sure, there may be less efficacy of Herceptin with low HER2 to chromosome 17 ratios, but is it really no effect? I mean, when it gets down to two, or is there still some effect even for low level amplification, but just not as robust an effect? That's a really interesting question to me, and I don't know whether the subsets will be large enough to really get a statistical answer to that question, but it's an intriguing issue, and I suspect that the final analysis will show that the higher the copy number, the greater the benefit of Herceptin.
We had a case-based tumor panel discussion yesterday. We had a case where the amplification was 2.02.
Yeah.
I mean, would you utilize trastuzumab, for example, in a patient like that, let's say node positive?
I have, and I don't know if that's the right answer, but 2 is the cutoff. I mean, biologically, to get a ratio above 2, there has to be an extra copy of the HER2 gene in the mix somewhere. It can't be explained away simply on the basis of ploidy or any other mechanism or just cells that are undergoing, you know, S phase during mitosis or what have you. So it's really tough to make these kind of calls, but I think you have to give patients the benefit of the doubt because the efficacy of Herceptin is so overwhelmingly important. You wouldn't want to deny that to somebody in the absence of any data to the contrary.
You know, another case that was really disturbing yesterday in this tumor panel discussion was a patient who was HER2 amplified 5.8, empath, large in a lab, and then went to Memorial, and they retested it and found it to be FISH negative. You know, we've always, obviously there are huge questions about IHC, but what about FISH?
Well, you know, the North American cooperative groups have looked at this issue, and they also find sort of a disappointing degree of concordance between community-based FISH and commercial reference lab FISH assays. To the contrary, though, Mike Press has looked at the BCRG database, and in the analysis of the first 2,600 samples that he and Guido Sarder looked at, they found a concordance rate between community FISH and central reference lab FISH to be about 92%. And that was a global study with, you know, labs all over the world doing FISH assays. Now, it's been argued that in that BCRG cohort that many of the non-US sites actually are sending their material to reference labs reflexly, so that that really is a concordance between reference labs to another reference lab, which is a reasonable argument. But, you know, I think it's an issue. The issue is, Should we rely on community labs for tests that are done infrequently and are technically difficult to do? And the answer may be no. I mean, there are many tests in the hospital in general internal medicine that are send-out tests that aren't run in the basement of UCLA on the best day. And maybe FISH is another one of these tests that we should just, you know, delegate commercial labs to do this with high volume and experienced technicians. And that would be fine.
You know, speaking of relatively non-toxic targeted therapy that reduces a relapse rate, you know, 40 or 50%, we have the same issue with ER. But with ER, we also have lots of data about false negatives, which is really disturbing when you think about somebody missing out on the opportunity to take hormone therapy. Do we know anything about the false negative rate with HER2, particularly with FISH?
All I know is work done in our labs at UCLA and Mike Press's work across town at USC. And in experienced hands, that rate is probably very low indeed. But I just don't know what happens in the real world in community hospitals if people are dabbling with the assay and just really don't know what they're looking at. The other issue with FISH is, of course, you're looking at a dark field. And so it's difficult to understand whether you're looking at an area of DCIS or the invasive component, et cetera. So there are a lot of technical issues that require considerable expertise to interpret these FISH assays.
And Mike Press has made the point to me, too, that if you look at IHC 0 and 1 plus, where you find, I guess, I don't know, maybe 5% FISH positives, that sound about right?
Sounds about right.
You know, that actually since... if you look at the demographics and the denominator is so big that the substantial proportion of the HER2 population would actually be identified as IHC 0 or 1 plus unless they had a FISH test.
Sure. I mean, I think it should be the gold standard test. At UCLA, we always request FISH assays if we need to know the HER2 status. There are some rare exceptions. Somebody has a small tubular well-differentiated node-negative cancer and it's strongly estrogen receptor positive, has very low S phase, et cetera, and the IHC comes back zero. Well, I'm not going to argue over a case like that. Similarly, pure lobulars are rarely HER2 amplified. So if a pure lobular came back as being zero or one plus, you know, I would probably buy that in most cases. But if it's a pleomorphic lobular or if it's less well-differentiated or whatever, then I would reflexly order a FISH on all those cases.
Let's drill down a little bit on the issue of chemotherapy in terms of chemotherapy to combine with trastuzumab. You said that if this patient had agreed to chemo, you might have thought about TCH because she was lower risk and you're concerned about cardiac toxicity. If she had been multiply node positive and had no special concerns about chemotherapy, what kind of chemotherapy would you have utilized?
It all depends on, you know, one's estimate of the cardiac risk. If it was a healthy patient, had a lot of nodes, and I thought that they could safely consider an anthracycline-based regimen, then I would certainly consider it. There is this data on co-amplification of the topoisomerase 2 gene, and on some occasions we've sent samples over to Mike Press to look at that for us, even off protocol occasionally. But, you know, for young, healthy patients, the lion's share of those patients will tolerate anthracycline-based regimens. And the fact of the matter is, even in the BCRG-006 cohort, the numerically superior arm, though it's not statistically significantly superior, but the numerical trend is clearly in favor of the anthracycline followed by, you know, Taxotere Herceptin regimen.
Any preference in terms of the taxane?
No. After the E1199 presentation in San Antonio, I do not feel strongly about the choice of taxane in this instance.
No, why would that? I mean, that wasn't in HER2-positive patients specifically. Why would that affect your decision?
Well, the reason we chose Taxotere from the get-go was, number one, you know, we felt that it had superiority over paclitaxel in, let's say, metastatic breast cancer. There was stronger synergism in preclinical cell-based assays as well. And so that's how that decision was made. It's a trade-off with toxicity, really, when you get down to it. And certainly the intergroup regimen of AC followed by, you know, weekly low-dose Taxol, that has such a smooth safety profile once you get out of the anthracycline part of the regimen. That's going to be tough to beat. You'd have to have clear superiority of another taxane to beat that sort of safety profile.
So prior to the San Antonio meeting, did you feel differently?
Well, I mean, we were using TCH reflexly prior to that because we had the BCRG-006 study open at our site. We were very comfortable with it. We treated a lot of patients with it. Of course, we published papers on the regimen in the metastatic setting. We have a collaboration with Judith Hurley in Miami with a neoadjuvant cohort treated with TCH Taxotere. with a very high path CR rate, I think on the order of 25% in tumors with a median tumor size of 9 centimeters. That data is in press now in JCO. So, you know, it's a very active regimen, and we're quite comfortable with it, and we could manage the toxicity satisfactorily.
But in terms of AC followed by taxane / trastuzumab, were you utilizing docetaxel, paclitaxel, or either prior to San Antonio?
Well, prior to San Antonio, again, since it was one of the arms in the BCRG-006 study, we were usually using taxotere, but I feel less strongly about that at this point.
Is that also true of Dennis?
Probably not. I think he might also stick to TCH as opposed to the anthracycline, unless they have topo II amplification.
Right. You mentioned the topo II, and that was one of the most interesting data sets I've seen in a long time. It's funny, I interviewed Dennis after the press release, and we talked, of course, about the BCRG study, but it was before San Antonio. And he told me off the record, didn't want it on the program, that he was really looking forward to seeing that topo II data.
Yeah.
He didn't know it at that time.
Right.
And I guess you guys only got it like 5 days before San Antonio.
It was like the night before.
Is that right?
Yes. That data came at the last minute.
Can you track out that story and what you looked at and saw?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, you know, some now very old data sets from the mid-1990s from the CLGB, there was a clear effect of anthracycline dose among the HER2-positive subset of patients that were analyzed in some of the old CLGB adjuvant studies. And that was a New England Journal paper, and that's what really gave rise to this whole paradigm that if you're HER2-positive, you uniquely benefit from anthracyclines. And that was confirmed by the NSABP. They did a retrospective subset analysis of their B11 study, which I think was an unusual adjuvant regimen back in the day of phenylalanine, mustard, and fluorouracil with or without anthracycline. And in that data set, again, was this clear benefit of the incorporation of anthracycline unique to HER2-positive subjects. Since that time, there have been some neoadjuvant studies looking at the issue of HER2 amplification and or overexpression and response to anthracyclines in the neoadjuvant setting, and there's a clear relationship between clinical response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy and degree of HER2 alteration in that setting. So the question then became, is this an effect of HER2, or is there some other explanation? And to address that question, I did a series of transfection experiments back when I was a fellow in Dennis Slamon's lab years ago. And back in the day, we figured that forced overexpression of HER2 in cell lines would cause them to be more sensitive to anthracyclines. After all, that's what the clinical data suggested. And when I actually measured the IC50s of HER2 transfected cells compared to control transfected cells, they didn't budge. They were spot on. HER2 did not confer special sensitivity to adriamycin at all. So at that point, we really had to scratch our heads and decide, you know, what can explain this clinical observation? The clinical observation is real. There was really no disputing it. So we looked at the HER2 amplicon and realized that the topoisomerase II gene is in close physical proximity on chromosome 17q, and on occasion, it is co-amplified along with the HER2 gene, and in as much as the topo II gene product is the target for the anthracycline antibiotics, it is targeted therapy to some extent after all, that might actually be what's driving the sensitivity of these cases. So that was the whole basis for Mike Press's subset analysis of the BCRG cohort. We realized based on the study design that we really had a unique opportunity because we had a non-anthracycline arm and an anthracycline arm, both of which had Herceptin, in a pure population of HER2 amplified patients. That was the other beauty of the BCRG study, is that the eligibility required demanded HER2 gene amplification by FISH to get on the study. So Dennis presented the preliminary data at the plenary, and Mike Press had a nice poster also summarizing the data. And it's important to realize, I think, at this point that it is interim analysis. It's a subset analysis. I think it's only the first couple thousand of the 3,200 cases, so it's not yet complete. So longer follow-up will be needed. We'll need to finish all 3,222 cases, et cetera, et cetera. But with those caveats, the hypothesis that co-amplification of topo II does confer additional benefit from anthracyclines seems to be indicated by this preliminary analysis. Now, the p-values aren't quite there yet. I think, you know, they're marginally significant, and it's going to take more time and completion of the data set with longer follow-up to see if that really will tighten up in terms of the statistics.
Can you actually describe, you know, what the curves sort of look like with the topo II amplified and not amplified?
So in the topo II non-amplified cohort, the two Herceptin-treated arms, that is TCH and AC followed by TH, were really, you know, pretty much spot on top of each other. So for topo II non-amplified cases, maybe you really don't need an anthracycline. In contrast, in the topo II amplified patients, the anthracycline-based Herceptin arm was numerically on top. It was trending towards superiority over TCH. And that
I was trying to remember, in the non-amplified, though, did both of those groups still look superior to the non-trastuzumab arm?
I think in that particular subset that surprisingly the non-Herceptin-treated arm that had amplification of both topo II and HER2 did surprisingly well and was competitive with Herceptin treatment, even as I recall, in that subset.
Well, that, I mean, because I've heard a couple people conclude, well, do you need trastuzumab in the topo II amplified patient?
I think you do, because if you look at those curves carefully, the Kaplan-Meier curve that's on the very top is the ACTH arm that had co-amplification of topo II. So I think you still need Herceptin in those patients, and that was still superior to the non-Herceptin arm. But the non-Herceptin arm did surprisingly well if they had co-amplification of topo II and were treated with anthracycline.
A few common questions, practical clinical questions in practice. What about dose-dense AC paclitaxel with trastuzumab? We know that dose-dense ACT is the most common chemotherapy regimen utilized in node-positive patients. What about that regimen plus trastuzumab?
It's being studied by the Memorial Group, and I believe that they have some data. And so far, they have not encountered untoward toxicity, to my knowledge, with the dose-dense AC followed by taxane Herceptin, Taxol Herceptin specifically. But, you know, it's still a small number of patients. There could still be rare cardiac complications that we just haven't seen yet because it hasn't been widely adopted. So I'm fearful that there will be immediate wide, you know, adoption of dose-dense adjuvant chemotherapy with Herceptin. And we may only then learn after thousands of patients have been treated that there could be a problem. So, you know, I really think it should be studied carefully first before it's widely adopted by the community. And those efforts are underway. But I think practicing clinicians could probably wait on the sidelines with this issue.
Just out of curiosity, in the HER2 negative node positive patient, what tends to be the chemotherapeutic regimen that you utilize off protocol?
It depends on the patient's age, performance status, comorbid medical conditions. There's any number of, you know, perfectly fine active regimens to choose from, and I usually give the patients a menu of options. It depends on, do they want to finish more quickly? Will their insurance cover the cost of growth factors? How many nodes do they have? There are a lot of different issues. And certainly when I'm seeing patients in consultation as a second opinion, if somebody gets referred in to me with node-positive disease and they've been recommended to have dose-dense adjuvant therapy, I'd say that's perfectly fine. That's certainly on the menu of options for those patients. But if somebody said, well, they were recommended to have TAC, I would say that's perfectly fine too. Or if they had FEC followed by Taxotere as a recommendation, I would say that's a perfectly good regimen for lymph node positive early stage breast cancer.
Also in the ER positive patients, there's been the controversy about whether TAC better than dose dense in those patients.
Well, for ER positive disease, I have a hard time justifying the dose dense approach. I mean, that subset, which is fully 2/3 of the 9741 cohort, is just really negative to date. Now, there's some theory that, you know, it'll take another 15 years of follow-up before those curves split. But I don't buy that. I think if you look at the principle upon which the dose-dense adjuvant regimen was devised, that is the Norton-Simon hypothesis, there has to be substantial regrowth of tumor cell populations between cycles in order for the dose-dense approach to work. And for an indolent ER-positive, slow-growing tumor, there's not going to be a substantial difference in the number of cells in somebody's body over 1 week time. And so the hypothesis, the Norton-Simon hypothesis, in my view, actually predicts that there should be a population of indolent, slow-growing breast cancers where dose-dense is not necessary. And that's exactly what the data set shows. And I don't know why there are some in the CLGB who just want this to be positive in the intent-to-treat population, ignoring the fact that breast cancer is a biologically diverse disease with different growth rates.
So what do you tend to utilize in those patients?
For ER-positive patients, again, it depends on their age, et cetera. If they're getting on in years, I'm more likely to use AC followed by weekly Taxol, for example, just because that's so well tolerated. if they're young and fit and, you know, in their 30s and have no comorbid medical illnesses and they have a number of positive nodes, I would have no hesitation using TAC in those patients because we participated in some of those TAC trials and we're quite comfortable with the regimen when we use Neulasta on day two for those patients. So I really do use a menu of options, and I do include dose dents as an option for patients, and I have given dose dents adjuvant therapy, even at UCLA.
You know, you sort of casually mentioned the Neulasta, and I thought that was sort of a given in terms of using the TAC regimen, in terms of what's been seen in terms of febrile neutropenia. I was really surprised. I was talking to Gary Lyme. He talked about the fact, I mean, his patterns of care data, he suggests that a substantial number of patients in the community who are getting TAC aren't getting Neulasta, which is kind of hard to believe.
Well, it's actually not hard to believe. And, you know, for the longest time, I didn't use growth factors with TAC because at UCLA, we had participated in the BCRG studies, which used prophylactic Cipro only. And in my personal experience, I got by with that fine, you know, just anecdotally for quite some time. And it was only really after looking at larger data sets and once the 001 data came in and showed, you know, like a 24% incidence of febrile neutropenia, which is obviously unacceptably high, that's when I made the switch personally. But I personally can't recollect having problems in my own patient population. Now, we have a skewed patient population at the university of largely young, excellent performance status patients that get referred into the university. The average age on that trial, as I remember, is only about 50, whereas the average age of breast cancer in the U.S. population is over 60. So it's a skewed view, and that's probably why I got away with without using growth factors for as long as I did. But now I routinely use them prophylactically.
I want to get back to HER2-positive patients in a second, but as long as we've tracked out into the HER2-negative chemotherapy question, I'm curious what your thoughts are about Steve Jones's presentation in San Antonio looking at the U.S. oncology trial of docetaxel cyclophosphamide versus AC.
I thought it was a really exciting presentation, and you know, I'm not surprised at all by the data. It's now join the list of several trials which have shown that incorporation of taxanes into the adjuvant setting is a positive thing.
Could you review what they saw?
Yeah, Steve presented a randomized trial of early stage breast cancers, approximately, as I recall, 40 to 50% of which were actually node negative in that study, which is also fascinating. They were randomized to four cycles of AC versus four cycles of TC, T being Taxotere in this case, 75-600, I believe, was the dose. And they showed a significant relapse-free survival advantage in the TC arm compared to the AC arm. And there was a numerical trend even in the survival analysis so far, although I don't think it reached statistical significance just yet. But Steve Jones concluded, and I think probably rightly so, that this constitutes basically a new regimen that replaces AC. If you're going to use a four-cycle regimen, you probably wouldn't want to use AC anymore based on this data set.
The toxicity and safety data looked pretty good also.
Yeah, I think I was, you know, favorably surprised by that as well, that the TC was quite well tolerated compared to AC. I think it just goes to show you that we probably underestimate the toxicity of AC rather routinely. I saw a young woman within the past couple of weeks in my clinic with newly diagnosed adriamycin toxicity after adjuvant therapy for, you know, what will probably be curable breast cancer. And so it's really sobering when you see cases like this, and it's scary.
Wow, what adjuvant therapy did she get?
She got six cycles of TAC.
Wow.
And EF of 40 to 45%, short of breath, had to go to see the cardiologist, et cetera.
How long ago did she get it?
She had just finished recently.
And how old is she?
I believe she was in her 40s, 45 maybe.
Wow. Yeah. So, and we know from our patterns of care studies that AC is the most common chemotherapy regimen utilized right now for node negative patients. Do you use a lot of AC in that situation?
Not a lot, Neil. I'll tell you, you know, my approach to node negative disease is that I believe that the lessons that we've learned with regard to the various regimens in the node positive experience most likely will translate into node negative disease, even though we don't have data necessarily proving that in terms of incorporation of taxanes, et cetera. But the biological principles are certainly there, and so I tend to generally use the same types of regimens for high-risk node-negative disease, that is high enough risk to merit chemotherapy treatment. And it's only under unusual circumstances where I would use just four cycles. Now, I have recently used the TC regimen since San Antonio
really?
In an elderly patient where, you know, four cycles is awfully attractive to a patient that you might be a little bit fearful of getting through all six or eight cycles of other regimens.
How old was this patient?
I believe she was in her 60s.
You got a low range of elderly, you know.
Just recently,
elderly's over 75. You know.
Yeah, she's a nun in Los Angeles.
Wow. And, so you gave her TC.
She's on four cycles of TC. Yeah.
Getting back to HER2 positivity at San Antonio, right after Dennis's presentation of 006, the FinHER study was presented, and that was published in the New England Journal. Can you talk about what that trial looked at and what they saw?
Well, this is an interesting study that looked at a couple of different questions, one being a comparison of Taxotere versus Navalbine in the adjuvant setting. And in the HER2 positive fraction, they also looked at addition of Herceptin or not to those two drugs. What they found, surprisingly perhaps, is that despite a pretty modest sample size, I think only a few hundred patients in that study, they were able to detect superiority of Taxotere over Navalbine, which actually surprised me a bit, although I think we all knew that Taxotere is probably somewhat more active than Navalbine just from our metastatic experience. But experience in the metastatic setting also has told me in practice that Navalbine is a very, you know, active drug, and so I would have thought you would have needed a much larger sample size to discriminate between those two, and yet they didn't. So that was kind of an intriguing finding in my view. But it confirms preconceived notions that Taxotere would be superior, so that's not surprising at all. The other finding was that the Herceptin arms were superior, which didn't surprise anybody, except for the fact that it was only about 9 weeks of Herceptin, as I recall.
This is like 200 HER2-positive patients,
small,
right?
Small subset, but it reached statistical significance. And in my view, that speaks to the robust nature of the efficacy of this drug. I mean, in retrospect, all of the adjuvant Herceptin studies are massively overpowered, and we never needed to do a 3,000-5,000 patient study to understand that Herceptin has efficacy. And this trial proves it. With a few hundred patients, they were able to demonstrate that a short course of Herceptin is effective. The hazard ratio is spot on with all of the other adjuvant Herceptin trials, which is also intriguing, and it opens the door for consideration of shorter courses of Herceptin, shorter than 1 year even. We're not ready to adopt this as any sort of standard of care yet, though, because the confidence limits around those hazard ratios in the FinHER study are going to be, I'm sure, sizable.
Well, plus, it's indirect comparison to other studies.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Cross-trial comparison. So, though it may open the door for consideration of study of shorter courses of Herceptin, at the current time, in the U.S. at least, the standard of care will be Herceptin for 1 year. And that'll probably continue to be the case until around 2008, when Martine Piccard has predicted we'll have some insight on the 1 versus 2 year comparison that's ongoing in the European HERA adjuvant Herceptin trial. If the 1 versus 2 year trial shows no difference, then everyone will be highly motivated to study shorter courses looking at less than 1 year. If the 2 year arm is superior to 1 year, then we'll never again look at any shorter courses.
Let's talk about the cardiac issues in trastuzumab, and it's kind of difficult for a person in practice to kind of sort this out because each trial sort of looked at different things. And can you sort of take a step back and sort of globally maybe even talk about what you might say to a patient about, you know, sort of what to expect from different trastuzumab regimens in terms of having decreased ejection fraction that might cause you to consider stopping therapy and actually the risk of having clinical cardiac events?
If you're going to consider an anthracycline-based adjuvant regimen in combination with Herceptin, or I should say followed by Herceptin with taxanes, you need to tell patients that there is a, you know, defined risk of cardiotoxicity. In particular, if you look at the NSABP adjuvant Herceptin data, about 4 to 5% of the patients just after 4 cycles of AC were ineligible to receive adjuvant Herceptin at all. So, you know, if you're in clinical practice, it would be important to measure the ejection fraction before and after just the AC to make sure that your patient would have met the eligibility for the study and you can draw upon that safety database. Moreover, during the year of adjuvant Herceptin for the patients who actually receive the drug, an additional approximately 15% of the patients had to drop out due to decreases in ejection fraction, which I find actually alarming. And, you know, I hope that short courses of adjuvant Herceptin are effective because a lot of those patients got apparently short courses. But at any rate, my fear is that in the community, busy practitioners are going to forget to get those echoes and MUGAs every 3 months like was done on all of the adjuvant Herceptin trials. And I'm fearful of what might happen for someone who has, you know, marked decreases in ejection fraction but maybe not having symptoms from heart failure yet, and because they didn't get their echo or MUGA or just continued on more Herceptin. That scares me. And I think clinicians need to know that if they're going to prescribe adjuvant Herceptin, they should do so following the same guidelines that were used in those protocols.
Can you go through exactly what those were?
It was assessment of EF every 3 months during the 1 year of Herceptin. And if there was a decrease in the ejection fraction, I believe it was to less than institutional norms, they had to drop out. If it dropped 15 points and was above institutional norms, they still had to hold the Herceptin at least temporarily and wait for recovery. If recovery happened on follow-up 1 month later, then they were allowed to attempt to reinstitute it in that instance, so long as they were not symptomatic and less than institutional norms. So, you know, there are these guidelines that are available from these protocols, and those really should strictly be followed, in my view, if you're going to employ anthracyclines.
Any preference of MUGO versus ECHO?
Probably not. You know, whatever the patient starts with, they need to stick with the same modality throughout, obviously, so that you can make fair comparisons. I tend to like MUGAs a little bit more if I have the feeling that I really need to know. What I find at UCLA is if I write status post Herceptin on the echo requisition, it always comes back about 5 points lower just because the cardiologist sees that on the requisition and guesstimates the EF to be a little bit less.
Wow, that's interesting. What about post completion of trastuzumab? Any recommendations in terms of follow-up ejection fractions?
You know, after patients have discontinued the Herceptin, it's difficult to say how much further surveillance they should need because there wouldn't be any intervention at that point. You know, they've already stopped the Herceptin, so what else are you going to do? In the absence of symptoms, you're probably not going to do anything. But to your point, this has been looked at in the BCRG cohort where they've been following EFs long-term even after completion of Herceptin, and surprisingly, they continue to see small but measurable decreases in ejection fraction that are sustained out to 700 or 800 days in the anthracycline arm.
In the trials, did they have an 18-month study?
They did have an 18-month, I believe.
From the trial point of view?
Yeah, was specifically to see whether there was recovery among the fraction of patients who had depressions in ejection fraction or to look for late drops even after completion of the Herceptin.
But you don't consider that part of the normal protocol in practice?
Yeah, I guess I would be less ambitious in sort of demanding that from the community at large because literally there's nothing that you would do to intervene at that point in the absence of symptoms, so I would think that it would be entirely optional. It was done for investigational purposes on the protocol, not for treatment purposes.
Again, in our community-based tumor panel-type discussions where people bring cases from their own practice, there's all kinds of situations where there are drops in EFs that people have questions about. For example, a patient who drops 15 points but still is above normal. Do you think that there should be some flexibility in whether or not to stop the trastuzumab or when to restart it that takes into account what the risk of the patient is and other issues like that?
Of course. I mean, I've certainly encountered patients off protocol that had lots of positive lymph nodes and their ejection fraction drops below the threshold where on the studies they would have had a temporary hold on their Herceptin, but they're asymptomatic and they're 1 point below the cutoff. I've encountered that on more than one occasion where it's literally 1 point less than the trigger point. That doesn't concern me so much, and a clinician with good judgment can exercise their own good judgment and follow those patients closely, and I wouldn't have a problem with that.
What would you say, just to sort of summarize it, in the anthracycline followed by taxane combined with trastuzumab, what would you say to the patient in terms of what their risk is of developing a clinical cardiac event, congestive heart failure, et cetera?
Well, for clinical congestive heart failure, it's a really low percentage risk. I mean, most of the adverse events were just measurable drops in ejection fraction in the absence of symptoms. So it's 3 or 4%, and it was highest in the North American trials, and it was actually lower in HERA and also lower even in the AC to TH arm in BCRG. It was only about 2.5% there. In the HERA study also, I think it was only a couple percent.
What about TCH?
The incidence of significant drops in ejection fraction on TCH was spot on with the non-Herceptin control arm, and in the BCRG data set, I believe it was 0.4%, so it's really low in the absence of the anthracycline. And I think it was 0.6% for the ACT arm.
The last thing I want to ask you about is the issue of bevacizumab plus trastuzumab. Where are we right now in terms of clinical research data on that question, and where do you think that's heading?
Well, the phase one study is complete. It was presented last year at San Antonio, and we've incorporated the data into a manuscript, which is in preparation to be submitted by a postdoc from UCLA. And so right now we're in the midst of the phase two component of that clinical trial. It's accruing well. We're up to nearly 30 patients out of the 50 planned in phase two, and it'll probably be wrapped up by the middle of this year, and we'll have efficacy data from the phase two cohort. We're following the safety data very closely in this Herceptin Avastin trial. In particular, we're really focused on cardiac safety, and there's a very, very stringent cardiac safety schedule built into the study design, and we're following that very intensely.
I know I had heard that, you know, when we talk about the next generation of clinical trials with trastuzumab, with HER2 positive patients, you were talking before about the fact that we didn't know that actually we were overpowered, but now we've got to have a real issue of how many patients are we going to need to show a benefit over just chemotherapy and trastuzumab alone. I had heard that the NSABP had talked to you guys and was interested in this concept of bevacizumab and trastuzumab. Do you think that's going to happen?
I think it will, but it all hinges on the pilot adjuvant bevacizumab trial that's underway now through ECOG, and so we're anxiously awaiting the safety analysis of that trial. Of course, the primary endpoint for that study is, in fact, cardiac safety.
Now, that's not necessarily HER2 positive, or
it's not. No, it's not. But
just in terms of the safety issue.
Yeah, the safety.
And that's bevacizumab alone.
Right.
With chemo.
With anthracycline-based chemo. So, you know, adjuvant bevacizumab really hinges on demonstration of safety because, after all, these are patients, many of whom who are going to be cured of their disease, and so clinicians are going to be loath to put patients through anything that might increase their risks of complications substantially. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what that data set looks like and see what our phase two metastatic bevacizumab-trastuzumab combination looks like before we can design the next adjuvant that might incorporate both. And I just want to add, too, Neil, that, you know, really practicing clinicians should probably wait on the sidelines to see these safety data sets before embarking on any of these combinations on their own. There is a really serious concern for safety with these types of combinations, and clinicians shouldn't do anything off protocol in the absence of the phase two data.
What's your take right now in terms of what we know about arterial events as well as cardiac toxicity with bevacizumab alone, not just in breast cancer, but just bevacizumab?
I think that, you know, there is concern for these events, but in some of the other disease cohorts, the risk for thromboembolic events was, you know, quite small. And so, you know, I'll be anxious to see how the pilot breast adjuvant bevacizumab study looks because it is using a novel chemotherapy base with anthracyclines, which all of the other disease states, I think, have used non-anthracycline regimens. I don't know if that'll change thromboembolism necessarily, but it's a defined risk, but I don't think that it's prohibitive from what I've seen from the colorectal data set or the renal cell data sets or other diseases, lung cancer, et cetera.
I mean, has cardiac, I mean, there's been clearly arterial events have been seen, but have there been any signals about cardiac toxicity?
Sure. If you look at the bevacizumab package insert, they describe a small but defined percentage of congestive heart failure in the bevacizumab arms of the colorectal studies, for example. Now, it's really small, you know, a couple, 3%, I think it was, but it's there. And it seems to be higher than in the control arm, though there are no statistics in the package insert. It is described, though, and so it is a concern. Mechanistically, from an armchair perspective, you know, one could envision that the hypertension that's associated with bevacizumab could increase the afterload on the heart. So if somebody has any sort of predisposing condition in the myocardium, it could be unmasked by the increase in afterload, and that could tip them over into a decompensated state if they were headed that direction in the first place. I have no idea if that's really the mechanism to explain these observations, but it's one mechanism that has been proposed, and it's a plausible one.
What other clinical trial strategies that are being discussed for the next generation of adjuvant trials for HER2-positive tumors?
Well, obviously, the small molecule ERBB2 kinase inhibitors are a very exciting class of compounds that could well be the next to be studied in the adjuvant setting in HER2-positive disease. Specifically, lapatinib seems to be the leader, though it's not a pure HER2 kinase inhibitor because it also inhibits the EGF receptor kinase. But be that as it may, it has clear activity in HER2-positive metastatic disease. And there's also an intriguing study in which we participated of a combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib. which looked pretty promising, even in patients with prior treatment failure on trastuzumab. There's a recent study out of South America looking at single-agent lapatinib in HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, and they have a response rate that's about a third, which is actually very similar to what Chuck Vogel presented for single-agent trastuzumab, first-line HER2-positive metastatic disease, suggesting that lapatinib may really have significant activity in this population of patients. And so it's poised, potentially, to be integrated into the adjuvant setting, either, you know, in combination with trastuzumab or following trastuzumab, or as a substitute for trastuzumab, perhaps, who knows? All these are very interesting questions that potentially could be addressed in a clinical trial.
Last thing I want to ask you about is Soon Paik presented some interesting data on c-MYC and adjuvant trastuzumab. Can you review that?
Oh, this is a fascinating, fascinating story, and that was just really beautiful, extraordinary data. Turns out that based on transgenic mouse models, that c-MYC actually can drive apoptosis. You know, it's sort of paradoxical to think of a proto-oncogene causing cell death, but there are a number of pathways that have been proven to be MYC-dependent that can drive apoptosis, some through the mitochondrial apoptotic pathway, some involving P53. And so it turns out that if you have, let's say in a transgenic mouse model, an activated receptor tyrosine kinase and MYC amplification, that really drives a malignant phenotype much more so than just a transgenic animal with MYC alone or with receptor tyrosine kinase, for example, alone. So really, it's probably a conspiracy between a receptor and MYC, which is a nuclear transcription factor, of course, that really seems to drive this. And in the absence of the signaling from the receptor tyrosine kinase, MYC actually is driving apoptosis more than proliferation. So if you can block the signal from the receptor tyrosine kinase, like HER2 or MET receptor, or there have been a number of other receptors that have been studied in these bi-transgenic animals. If you can block that signal, then you unmask the pro-apoptotic effects of MYC, and you can drive tumors into apoptosis. And if you look at the NSABP data that Soon Paik presented, in the patients that had MYC co-amplification, when they were treated with trastuzumab, they just had extraordinary outcome, you know, just really almost no relapse events in that cohort, suggesting that really this crosstalk between HER2 and MYC is important in predicting response to trastuzumab. So it looks to me like MYC amplification is going to be a powerful predictive marker for response to adjuvant trastuzumab, and the biological basis is understood from these historical bi-transgenic mouse models. So it's a wonderful example of translational science and understanding of tumor biology, and it's proven and validated in a clinical cohort.